Hi, everyone, and welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Sophia Simonello.
And I'm Nick Rookrout.
And today we're going back in time. Last week we had our award season fantasy draft, looking ahead to the future of the year and this Oscar season. And today we're going back 50 years to 1974. We've covered quite a few 1974 films already this year. The Godfather Part II, Chinatown, The Conversation. And now it's time to do a little double feature of Mel Brooks comedies. We're talking Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
This is not the only double, and I don't think I realized it until my rewatch viewings for this episode. But yeah, we hinted at doing a Mel Brooks episode, touching on 1974 one more time because we love this year so much. And I think this is a fitting way to maybe wrap a bow on that year. TBD if we sneak something in. But Mel Brooks in general, he's obviously a comedy genius and was so beloved at the time, still is. But these films, I think, are two of his best. And coming out the same year, I think that says a lot about his craft and who he was in the 70s. He had already won his Oscar for The Producers. And I think these coming after have a little bit of that in them. But I also think these two movies are very, very different from one another, which I think is going to be fun to talk about, even though, you know, we have Madeline Kahn in both films and there are obviously similarities to them as well. But I think this will be a very fun episode and two movies, again, that are Oscar nominated. So we did want to keep it on the main feed.
Yeah, I'm excited we're doing this. I think Mel Brooks is somewhat underrated, honestly, or at least under-discussed, especially when it comes to 1970s cinema. But also, I think just with people who talk about the Oscars, I think it may also just be rare that we get to talk about comedies because they're never recognized at the Oscars. I feel like we're always in these very dark, serious places where we're talking about dramas and prestige films. And here we have two comedies that have really, I think, stood up as quintessential comedies of the 70s, but also just earned their place in film history. Mel Brooks, he was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Williamsburg. He's a fellow Cancer like us. He had such an interesting background too. Like, he wrote on Your Show of Shows with Carl Reiner and Neil Simon. He worked with a very young Woody Allen early in his career. He was in stand-up and television. And then as he gets into film, he won a screenplay Oscar for The Producers. He beat Stanley Kubrick for 2001. So that is, I think, one of those big Oscar successes for him. But he really, I think, doesn't, for me at least, when I think of Mel Brooks and his success in the industry, it's really the 1970s when he rose in his career and you have these two really strong comedies. And we'll talk about how they play today. But I think when we think about the 70s, they're very bold and they're addressing, especially in the case of Blazing Saddles, issues in the film industry and also society more broadly. They both operate as genre spoofs, but also look upon their genres with reverence, especially when it comes to the filmmaking itself. And they just do what the best comedies do, which is they look at these social issues, political issues, and they use comedy to make a point as to how society has or hasn't evolved. So I'm excited to talk about both of these today. And like you mentioned, to talk about Madeline Kahn.
All of those things you were describing is hard to do in a movie, let alone a comedy. And I think he just accomplishes that so easily. And I think it's perfect to start off talking about Blazing Saddles. So the description of that movie: a town where everyone seems to be named Johnson stands in the way of this railroad being built. In order to grab their land, robber baron Hedley Lamarr sends his henchmen to make life in the town unbearable. After the sheriff is killed, the town demands a new sheriff from the governor, so Hedley convinces him to send the town the first black sheriff in the West. This is directed by Mel Brooks. It stars Cleveland Little, Gene Wilder, Madeline Kahn, Harvey Korman, and Mel Brooks himself. Was nominated for three Oscars, including Supporting Actress for Kahn, film editing and original song for the song Blazing Saddles. So what did you think of this movie? Had you seen it over time? Because I think that's something that's really important to me and how like I have developed in appreciating this film. When did you first see this one?
This was actually a first time watch for me. Wow. I had never seen it before. Mm-hmm.
That's a rarity here. I'm so excited.
It is. I watch too many movies, especially too many 70s movies, but I don't know why this one had evaded me. It is a major classic. It's on a number of lists. It is one of the highest grossing Westerns of all time, and it made a ton of money. So it is odd that I hadn't seen it before. I also love Gene Wilder, so extra strange that I hadn't seen it. But I actually am glad I waited to watch it, because I do think that watching a lot of 70s movies helped me contextualize it within the time and not have expectations of putting it in the current era. I think that I was then able to see how bold it was in its satire, especially in, you know, how it looks at intolerance and prejudice and the hatred that's really at the core of America, and using references to so many Westerns to do so. And I love the ending. I think that the ending is fantastic. Up until then, I appreciated the movie and thought that parts of it were very funny, and also understood that this is just not really my kind of movie. And then at the end, it really clicked in and I ended up really loving that. But I think I do appreciate maybe my darker, more wicked 70s movies like Chinatown and The Godfather Part 2 than something like this.
Yeah, I think it can be a hard movie to understand, especially the ending, which kind of comes at you out of left field, which is also what is so fun about this movie. It's obviously built on so many gags, and that really is the majority of it, but there is this really political standpoint and ideas that Brooks is filling this movie with. And I think if you're careful, you can pick up on it along the way. But it's also, I think, you know, looking back 50 years, people may have a hard time in understanding what he was actually trying to do, and that some of those things, I think, can really throw you off and maybe make you hate this movie immediately. I think like the repetition of using the N-word is really hard to hear. But I think the ideas behind that of, you know, showing how racist Hollywood is, or people were, and that the people of this town were in this film, I think that idea is really sharp and really smart. So I think it's breaking down all of these ideas that he was doing, but I do agree on the ending. I absolutely love it. What he does in throwing musicals in there and this brawl through the Warner Brothers lot is just so much fun. And going to the Chinese theater, I love how the jokes really come together in that moment too.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because this is one of my dad's favorite movies. So I was introduced to parts of this very young, and I just remember like the baked bean scene around the campfire, maybe being one of the first things I ever saw.
The earliest bathroom humor, the earliest fart-specific humor in an American movie, maybe?
It's a lot. It's nearly too much for me, but again, it's some of those stupider gags that maybe worked at the time, but I think, again, also speaks to how much money this movie made. I think adjusted for inflation, it was either first or second in the box office for the year with like $120 million. And I think that is just almost absurd to me in itself that it did so well, because Brooks himself was scared that it wasn't actually going to do well. And they almost didn't release it because the producers were like, I don't know about that.
Yeah. It's a really, really risky movie. And I think what's really crazy about it, and yes, I agree, you know, if you do watch it through a 2024 lens, what is interesting, though, is that I think for people watching it in 1974, they would say, and Mel Brooks did say, people are behaving today the way that they did in 1874. And you can watch it today in 2024 and say, well, not much has changed in 150 years, actually, because there are people in this country who still behave that way. And what's so bold about it really is that Westerns were the big box office earners in Hollywood history. It's like how we think of a Marvel movie today. So by making a spoof of a Hollywood Western, you know, he's referencing Once Upon a Time in the West, High Noon, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, these huge epic Westerns, by referencing those really explicitly and then adding the race element to it and condemning these horrible white people in the movie, making them look like idiots. He's very clear about that. And I think audiences still today have issues when there are racist characters in films. And it's, I think, very clear that the director is making them look like idiots, but they still have a hard time, I think, understanding maybe why that's in the film. And here, I think Brooks is pretty clear about this as making them look like they're the dumbest people in the room or the worst people in the frame. But using the Western, the biggest genre that Hollywood history had really seen up to that point, as a Trojan horse for those ideas, I think that's pretty smart. And then to do that in the end with a musical, adding that in, this kind of like Busby Berkeley big studio musical on the set, is so interesting. It's just so different. And I almost wondered if that's what Damien Chazelle wanted the end of Babylon to be like.
I could see that. I mean, that does make sense now. Yeah. And just a cacophony of sounds and ideas and showing Hollywood, or Warner Brothers in this case, as a collision of everything that was happening and that he was bringing to the front with this movie. And I think ironically, it's maybe why this wasn't up for a screenplay, is that it was too risky. But I think that's why I really appreciate the film, is what he's saying or trying to say, and really the way he does it, which also I think speaks to the editing nomination. The musical of it all, I think that points to my favorite scene in the movie, when we're introduced to Madeline Kahn's character, who is just way over the top. She has this wacky, almost German accent, and she has this huge musical number. Also something we have in Young Frankenstein, but it is so extravagant and really just stops the movie from what's happening to have this scene. And I think it's also a way that he melds these genres really well and defies our expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also love that scene and think that she's just comedic gold. I think that in this movie and in Young Frankenstein, the way that she uses her sex appeal and sexuality as a gag is perfect. And I think, too, what you were saying with the script, it is really daring. I read that Mel Brooks also had a sign up that said, "Please do not write a polite script," as a note to his writer's room. He'd worked with writer's rooms before when he'd been on TV, but here we had 5 different people working on the script together. So you can just imagine, with all of those voices in the room, that's even, I feel like, a more difficult process to come up with a coherent script. But one of the most important things there is that one of the writers was Richard Pryor. And originally, Mel Brooks wanted Richard Pryor to play Bart, the sheriff, but the studio didn't want to take a risk on him. So they hired Cleavon Little instead, but Richard Pryor stayed in the writing room. And I think that's so important too, because then you don't just have all these white guys writing this story about race and this satire about race. You do have Pryor there to shed a little bit of light, I think, on his experience and to make that feel more authentic in the film.
Yeah, and I think seeing Bart's journey from being a slave, they have these gags there where they have this like jazz band in the middle of the desert, which I love. But how he is treated by all of the white people in power, from the sheriff to the governor, and how no one believes in him, to him having the power, becoming the sheriff, and proving everybody wrong with his smarts and wit, which I think is also really clever. And those are parts that I really love, like seeing him come in when Mongo has everybody in the saloon and then Bart comes in, he has the telegram, and he kind of outsmarts Mongo in that moment, even though he's just this like big dumb criminal. So it's fun seeing him have fun with the script too, and how him and Gene Wilder have a really good time in the sheriff's office. They play chess, and then learning he was the Waco kid, seeing all of that. I think it's fun when he's shooting at all the criminals. But bringing it back to Bart, in the end, you know, he is this hero. He does have that great character arc that he deserves to have.
And there are so many funny moments with him too in the script. Like the scene when they're welcoming him and he's riding in the distance and all of the people in the town are aghast that this black man is their new sheriff. And when he gets up on the podium and he says, "Excuse me while I whip this out," and it's just the paper for his speech, and everyone in the crowd screams. It's like they're playing on how, again, these white racist townspeople are so scared of him and how their fear is intertwined with their racism. And that goes even further into the scene when Bart and the Waco kid see the KKK robes in the back of them say, "Have a nice day," A plus satire. But then when they turn around and the Waco kid says, like, "I got something for you." And then Bart steps out and he says, "Where are the white women?" And they start like charging at him. That, again, it's very dark humor, but it's making fun of the white people and all of their preconceived notions of who Bart is. And Bart is smarter. He knows exactly what they want to hear and messes with them. And that's, I think, what makes the comedy still hold up, is these things are still true.
I mean, we talk about all the racial politics and we've mentioned guns, but in that scene when he's not really welcomed as the new sheriff, they all pull guns on him. And so there's that idea too of using weapons when it's not necessary at all. Another line that I really love is when Jim is imprisoned and he says, "I must have killed more men than Cecil B. DeMille." It's like, oh my God, this thing goes everywhere. But I think it does hit all of the right notes, making fun of itself, making fun of Hollywood, and doing that in the end by actually going there.
The writing is just so, it is, it's dark, but it's so clever. Like even the way, again, like you said, with the Cecil B. DeMille line, the way it pokes fun at Hollywood history is so good. I mean, even naming Hedley Lamarr, Hedley Lamarr is funny. And Hedley Lamarr wanted to sue them.
Well, she did sue them and she got
her
money.
They settled out of court, right? Yeah.
She made like $100,000 back in the day. Wild. It's like, that's insane. But Mel Brooks was also so appreciative of that. He's like, okay, I accept, you know, talk to her, because he worshipped her and that's what he wanted to do. And finding a name for the villain for Hedley Lamarr, he was also referencing like old Hollywood and some of those actors and characters. And he settled with this name that I think just works so well. It's my favorite long joke of the film that comes back around in the very end when they're at the Chinese theater, they're looking at the handprints, and all throughout the movie, he's like, "My name is Hedley," and everyone's like, "Hedy," and he's like, "No, it's Hedley." And so there are these tourists looking at the handprints at the Chinese theater, and she goes, "Oh my gosh, look, it's Hedy Lamarr's shoes," and he passes her, and he goes once again, he's like, "No, it's Hedley." And I just thought the payoff for that joke, I was like, oh my God, this is annoying at this point. But it finally made sense. And I think made me appreciate all the humor even more when things finally wrapped up.
Yeah. And I think by the time the ending rolls around, that's when all of those jokes come together so well. And we do have that payoff. It's the, it's combining Hollywood history with the tropes of the Western, and I think looking at it in a really smart way, because in the end, too, like Bart rides off into the sunset. It's that perfect Western hero ending for the character. And then it's just not what it seems. And I love that it just goes in a completely unexpected direction, because I think the time that you first see that ending, it is kind of shocking because the world that it creates is so specific and so embedded in the idea of, you know, critiquing this Hollywood Western or a spaghetti Western, and then stepping outside of that into the larger system, I think that is what makes this a classic that stands the test of time.
I agree. So in wrapping up, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I think I would give Madeline Kahn Best Supporting Actress. Screenplay is tempting, but she was the highlight of the film for me. I think that all of the best scenes in the movie are also her scenes. And I just think she has the best comedic time, and she gives for me the most memorable performance. And I'm glad that she was actually nominated for an Oscar.
This feels like kind of an inspired nomination because it is a very short performance, but she does capture, I think, a lot of the energy of this movie. You can't think of Blazing Saddles and not think of her. But for my Oscar, I will be going with director for Mel Brooks. I think his ideas, his comedy, everything he put into this movie comes together so well. The jokes, the darkness, the political undertones, everything he was getting across, and the fact that this did really well at the box office shows how successful it was and that being risky does work. And yeah, I applaud him for that. My one other favorite joke from the movie, again, this movie has like hundreds of jokes, but the one that made me really laugh when I was watching it, since I'm not awarding its screenplay either, it's when Hedley Lamarr goes to the theater to buy a ticket for the movie. And he goes, "One please, student." And you just hear the attendant go, "Are you kidding?" And it's like, how long can you milk your student ID? It's just,
that is good.
The dumbest kind of joke, but also something that I'm like, wow. Yeah, the 70s are very much alive still today.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And the next movie we have is Young Frankenstein. Description here, a young neurosurgeon inherits the castle of his grandfather, the famous Dr. Victor von Frankenstein. In the castle, he finds a funny hunchback, a pretty lab assistant, and an elderly housekeeper. Young Frankenstein, or Frankenstein, as he says, believes that the work of his grandfather was delusional. But when he discovers the book where the mad doctor described his reanimation experiment, he suddenly changes his mind. This was directed by Mel Brooks and stars Gene Wilder, Peter Boyle, Marty Feldman, Cloris Leachman, Terry Garr, Madeline Kahn, Gene Hackman. This is a crazy ensemble. It is stacked. This was nominated for 2 Oscars, Adapted Screenplay and Best Sound. What did you think of Young Frankenstein? Was this the first time you'd seen it? Did you grow up with it? What do you think of this movie?
I didn't grow up with this movie, and really Blazing Saddles was the only one of Mel Brooks's filmography. I have seen Spaceballs at some point, but seeing the clips of the alien sequence come up, I'm like, I do not remember that. So I have to go back and rewatch that. But for this one, I've only seen it a few times pretty recently, probably the last couple of years, but I still really love it. I think it's so smart. So inventive. We have so many adaptations of Frankenstein since the originals by Universal. Yet, I think this one is so necessary because of what he does with the story. He makes it into a comedy. He makes it very much his own and imbues it with all these beautiful nods to other ones that have come previously. But he also still makes it feel dark. I love the black and white cinematography, the lighting, everything that goes into it. So I think it's another classic, probably more so than Blazing Saddles. Like you said, this cast is just insane. And I briefly at the top mentioned a double. We've talked about The Conversation before. Gene Hackman is back. And I don't know if I recognized him before, but him playing this blind man, it's just so funny because, again, it's way over the top. He ends up burning the monster, and it's just such a good time. I really love it. What do you think about this movie? Do you really like it?
I love it. I actually also should say that I'm not really into horror comedies normally. I like my psychological thrillers. I like my demonic possession horror movies. Like, my favorites are the classics, which are all really dark. I would say, like, the closest thing to a horror comedy that I really love is Carrie, because I think Piper Laurie's performance is so funny in certain moments. And I know she thought of it as a comedy as well. But any of those, like, what you think of when you think of horror comedies, I'm just not into them, except for Young Frankenstein. I think this is the gold standard of horror comedy. And I think it's Mel Brooks's best movie. And I think he thinks the same, that it's the best movie he's made. I love what you said, right? It's a spoof of these 1930s Universal monster movies, but it also takes the tenets of them and really, I think, looks at that genre lovingly, shooting it in black and white and not in color. And Mel Brooks not letting the studio tricking him into shooting it in color, I think, really pays off. It looks beautiful. It was shot on some of the original Frankenstein sets, too. And I feel like you can feel that throughout. It has all of these really beautiful touches that makes it feel like it's a movie from that time. And Mel Brooks was also really adamant with his DP that he wanted it to feel like a 30s movie. He didn't want zooms. He wanted a camera that shook a little bit and that felt like it had that feel of something that was really old. It didn't have the advances of 1970s cinema and filmmaking. So I think you can see that all over this film. There's incredible comedic timing from this cast. I think they're all operating on all cylinders and absolutely perfect together. And I loved learning that a huge reason why this happened was because Gene Wilder had this idea for so long, and he has a story and screenplay credit alongside Mel Brooks, as well as the Oscar nomination. And he, when he was working on Blazing Saddles, told Mel Brooks that he wanted to make this movie with him, and they worked together on it. The only fight they got into, we can talk about that, is the musical number. Gene Wilder, when he was on Conan O'Brien before he passed away, said that that was the only fight he and Mel Brooks ever got in, was on whether or not that scene should be included. Wilder, of course, was adamant on its inclusion. And it's, of course, one of the most iconic scenes from the movie. But I think both of their connection to the material, Wilder taking this story that had been percolating for a long time in his mind, and it really works as, I think, a really good sequel, or whatever you want to call it, part of the Frankenstein universe. But Mel Brooks, I loved this story he shared in this little documentary that I watched, which was that when he was young, it was really hot one summer, and they, of course, didn't have air conditioning. It's the 1930s. And he wanted to sleep out on the fire escape of his apartment. And he told his mom, though, that he couldn't because he was scared that Frankenstein would come get him. And his mom said to him, Frankenstein lives in Transylvania. He would have to take multiple trains and the subway and a lot of time to get here. And she said, is it really worth his time to come get you on the fire escape? And I was like, wow. It just made me realize Mel Brooks probably inherited that sense of humor from his mother, because that's hilarious.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah, we know this monster so well. So I think it was a difficult task to reintroduce this in a new way. And I like that the set is the same, but then this monster that we get, played by Peter Boyle, who to me made me think of Uncle Frank from Home Alone. I feel like they're very similar looking actors, but he has such a softness that he imbues the monster with that I think I really like. And that comes out obviously once this violin tune plays and he's somewhat serenaded by that music, and that brings him back to the castle. But what I also like about the monster in the story is that we know what's going to happen, more or less. We understand this character and these characters, what happened to the Baron and in trying to reanimate life. And Brooks adds this to the screenplay by having one of the town elders say, we still have nightmares from the five times before, meaning the original films that came before, as if we were living in that universe. So I love that. He kind of expects that from us too, but still flips it on its head, because there are still new things that we learn and gimmicks or gags that he adds that maybe we wouldn't have expected, even though we understand this world that we're in.
Yeah, I love that. He takes genre convention and the history of Frankenstein and really creates something brand new and fun. And I think one of the reasons why this movie works as well as it does is because of that cast and the environment that they created on set. There are stories from this shoot that this was just the best time all of these actors had, and that people would actually go in on their days off just to watch what the other actors were doing. And Mel Brooks would even shoot additional scenes because he didn't want it all to end when it was over. It was just that fun for everyone. And I love how Cloris Leachman, when she talks about her role, she says, you know, she always wanted to bring a serious tone into the comedy because that made it funnier. And you can absolutely see that with her character. Terry Garr, I loved this story. Her mom was working on the movie at the time. Terry Garr was brand new. And she heard that they were casting it still. So, of course, she was interested. And she was one of, you know, tons of women who were reading for Elizabeth, including, she said, Farrah Fawcett, which is wild. And Mel Brooks said, told her, you know, we already have Madeline Kahn for Elizabeth, but can you come back tomorrow with a German accent? And at the time, she was working on the Sonny and Cher show, and Cher's wig maker was German. So she just imitated her. And that's how she got the role, which is so fun.
I mean, there's such a rich history. I love all of that.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite scenes from the movie or favorite quotes? I feel like this movie is really quotable.
I didn't write down as many as I did with Blazing Saddles, but I will say for my scenes, just how the movie starts. It's a 90-second long take of exposition. It's getting us into the castle, but I think it is so effective without having to explain anything to us. It's very moody. It's dark. It sets the time and the scene. And I love how it just tracks and dollies around the Baron's casket. And then it opens it up and we eventually see what we don't know yet to be the will and someone taking it. So it also adds this mystery element that I really like. There's a little bit of the comedy, not really yet, but we see his skeleton clutching that will. Mm-hmm. And there's something just so magical and mystifying about starting a movie, a comedy nonetheless, like this. So that kind of shocked me on rewatch and like, oh, they're doing like really cool things here. And again, I think that takes it back 40 years to those other Frankenstein old Universal films. And then from there, we meet Dr. Frankenstein, who adamantly denies his name and birthright until one of the most iconic monologues in the movie. But before we get there, do you have any other scenes that you like, or I guess lines?
I love that opening too. It's like he is rejecting the history of his name. He doesn't want to be associated with his grandfather, and that just makes it even funnier, I think. And Gene Wilder here, I think his comedy is perfect. And this role is great for him because it perfectly taps into the neurotic qualities that he has. He's a very manic performer at times. I love that. I feel like he's genius Wilder to me. And I feel like this character should be completely unlikable, someone you don't root for at all. But I find myself so drawn in by him every time. In any scene that he's in, I'm along for the ride. And I think if any other actor played him, that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, I love Gene Wilder really in everything that he does. But I mean, at times, do I think he's playing it too loud? Maybe.
That's the tone of the movie, though, with his character.
I know. He's always either upset or just angry or fighting, really, with everybody. I think that makes me like the love scenes with Elizabeth maybe a little bit more because of how there Madeline Kahn or Elizabeth is trying to avoid having sex with his character. And it's just so funny. I mean, when she says goodbye to him at the train station And she's like, oh, don't touch the nails, the hair, the dress, everything about her. And then she shows up. It's like, what? How? Why? And in those scenes, again, there's more comedy with Igor and her, but there's still that distance. And I think Gene Wilder handles that. You can see his frustration, how much he likes Elizabeth. He's doing more in those moments, I think, for me, than when he's screaming at the classroom or getting really upset with anybody. But similarly to Elizabeth, I think there are those moments with the monster too, when he's stuck in his cell in that room or on stage, once he kind of cozies up to the monster and understands how he works and really just who he is inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think part of the, like, what you would consider over the top, those moments of his performance, I think he's leaning into this idea of the mad scientist a little bit. You mentioned Igor. I love that too, because Marty Feldman actually, you know, had those eyes. That's part of the character mm-hmm. in the performance. But the name pronunciation, not being Igor, being Igor, that plays so well off of Frankenstein too. And I think that he as a character has so many of the best comedic moments in the movie. I love when he says, could be worse, could be raining. Great line. Very quotable. I also love when Frankenstein says he can help him with that hump. And he says, what hump? It's just so silly. The other, like, really early moment that makes me laugh is when Frau Blücher is carrying the candelabra up the stairs and she tells them to stay close to the candles and the candles aren't lit. That's so funny to me. It's just little things like that, just extra details that make the comedy so much better. Mm-hmm. And we need to talk about Madeline Kahn too. It was her idea to wear the monkey fur, the fur coat at the beginning. Also her improv, which is a great moment that I love, when he blows the kiss to her and she ducks. That's so good.
Yeah, she's the best. I think more so here, she deserved another nomination. Once she gets to the castle and is taken by the monster, she has those white stripes in her hair, obviously calling back to Bride of Frankenstein, which I think is a really clever way to, again, connect those movies. My other favorite moment with Igor is when he's going to get the brain and he breaks into the door and he slides his hand through that brain mail slot, drop them off after 5 p.m. And he looks around the door and his hand scares him. It's like, this is so stupid. But even the smallest jokes that, you know, you've seen done hundreds of times, it uh-huh. still is so funny here. And on rewatch, just watching these same things happen. You mentioning the candelabra. Mm-hmm. There are so many jokes that I just, I'm sure, didn't get. So that's also the fun of it, of going back and noticing new things, not only mm-hmm. details, but full-on jokes, which are just yeah. coming by the handful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the fun thing about this movie, too, is everyone has their own quotable line that they love when they're watching it. And also every character has their moment. That's why the ensemble is so strong, because they go really back and forth from who I think is dominating the scene, who the straight man is, who's delivering the punchline in one moment, and who is in the next. I like that it goes back and forth between different characters because they're all so funny to me at different points in the movie. And it's hard to pick a favorite. I do also love the, you mentioned Gene Hackman. He also hadn't really done comedy, but I love the I was going to make espresso line that uh-huh. he has. Even when that girl goes flying through the window back into the bed, that made me laugh so hard.
I mentioned the famous monologue from Gene Wilder, and he ends with, no, I'm Dr. Frankenstein, changing his name. But that going right into the putting on the Ritz mm-hmm. musical number is just such a great sequence of events. We get to see the monster in a tux in front of an audience. And I think it's smart how we hear him sing and dance, but then, you know, this fire, when the ball blows up, sets him off. And that kind of sets us on a darker path to the very mm-hmm. end. But I love that conclusion as well. We have this whole Elizabeth and the monster having sex thing and the singing, which I think is really funny, that comes back in the very end, and the whole transference sequence that is so good at suspense. And there's this ticking clock that it's like, oh my God, if you just waited a little bit longer, everything would have been fine. So while we know this to be a comedy, maybe a dramedy at times, there are still other elements that make it something totally different. And I think that's what elevates it for me too.
Yeah, I think so too. A few other honorable mentions for the quotes, because again, there are so many. It's Alive, big one. Walk This Way inspired Steven Tyler to write the song Walk This Way because he loved this movie so much. But yeah, the script is full of just so many great moments for all of the characters. And I'm glad that Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks both share screenplay credit.
Yeah, also hearing stories of them just kind of hunkering down and sharing ideas. I mean, it makes me really want to just write something with a friend. Like, how much fun that would be, just going back and forth, sharing your ideas, seeing what the other one thinks would work. And yeah, it's funny that Mel Brooks, of all people, didn't think that sequence would work, the dancing, putting on the Ritz scene, because that also mm-hmm. is a scene in Blazing Saddles with the Madeline Kahn introduction. It's like, it works.
Yeah. When something works, sometimes you just got to stick with it, I guess.
He's like, uh-oh, they're going to think I do the same thing.
What kind of screenplay would we write?
I don't know. Would we ever settle on one idea?
Probably not.
Can't be a period piece. Can't be in space. Can't. Or we make it those things, a period piece in space.
It's, yeah, there you go. A period piece in space. I was going to say it'd be like Blazing Saddles, where you could do one genre the whole way through, and then whichever one of us didn't get our way with the majority would just take over in the last 10 minutes with whatever genre the we ending. Wanted. Yeah.
Honestly, I like that idea.
So I think it's kind of odd that this, I mean, it only got 2 Oscar nominations. It's great that as a comedy it got 2, but none of the actors were nominated. So that's a good lead-in to our next question. Do you think anything was snubbed?
You mentioned at some point today that we don't really get to talk about comedies, and I think that's the problem with the Oscars and why they aren't nominated, is that fact alone. Because I do think, like, Cloris Leachman, I love her here. Great supporting performance, just like Madeline Kahn in Blazing Saddles. But is there room for a performance like that? I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe you would take out Talia Shire for The Godfather Part 2, but it's like,
yes,
extremely different performances. Plus, give Madeline Kahn 2 nominations. I don't care that they're both in supporting, because mm-hmm. she's so good.
Yeah, she is. You could do a special, like how they used to, like a joint nomination, Madeline Kahn for Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Ooh, yes.
I think you could do that. We could make up our own rules. What I love is that she was one of the runners up at the New York Film Critics Circle.
Oh, wow. See, they get it right.
Yeah. And she and Cloris Leachman were both nominated at the Golden Globes. So sometimes the Golden Globes, they know.
I was going to say, this is a Golden Globes situation mm-hmm. where hopefully more of them would get in. Also Gene Wilder, because yeah. Again, it's all of his movies. He overperforms in a good way, and I would have liked to have seen him too. For carrying this material, not only in the screenplay, but on screen too.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, he would have been, I think he would have been a great nomination. We can kick out, I mean, that's a good year for actor. I will say we've talked about it
mm-hmm.
quite a bit, but I don't know. You can kick out Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. I'm okay with that. Put Gene Wilder in. Poor Art Carney. He gets beat up a little bit on all of our 1974 episodes. But Madeline Kahn and Cloris Leachman agreed. And take out Towering Inferno. Put this in for Best Picture. I'm good with that, too.
Also, cinematography. I would have loved that. We have talked about that category quite a bit, how that and editing are a little similar. We obviously have the Blazing Saddles nomination there, but I think the techniques they used and how the film looks is just really sharp and adds to why this film works so much.
I agree. That's a good nomination. And it's really beautiful. I'm so glad that they stuck with the black and white. Even just the scene of Frankenstein and Elizabeth by the train, it feels like a film noir in a way, and I love that.
So to wrap up here with Young Frankenstein, if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
I would give this Best Adapted Screenplay for Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder. It's a very creative and fun adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, playing in that space, making it into this horror comedy. The screenplay for me is a huge reason why this stands the test of time and why this is as beloved as it is, why so many people quote it, why it's inspired so many filmmakers and comedians. I think it's the screenplay, and I wanted to find a way to recognize both Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder. They're, I think, the two from the movie for me that really make it work in the way that it does. So I'm going to go adapted screenplay. What about you?
I'm going to do the same thing. I really want to award both of them. They both deserve it and more. But it was also funny because Mel Brooks showed up in Blazing Saddles and he didn't hear. And Gene was like, okay, I'll do this, but you can't be in it. And he was like, okay. So not that it works because he's not in it, but I think that's really funny. Just this play between them that they had. Mm-hmm. Again, you can kind of see that camaraderie, that friendship in the written word, but also in just how comfortable Gene feels on screen. So I love that this script gets to really showcase all of the actors, gets the setting really right, all of the comedy, everything is just pitch perfect to me. So I loved revisiting this. I'm glad we did this double. If you haven't seen them, I highly recommend watching them. They're just streaming right now. There's got to be some physical media of like a double feature for this. If not, there really should be.
I agree. So that was our episode on Mel Brooks's 1974 Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, two of film history's greatest comedies. I'm glad that we got to talk about both of these. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we'll have a fall movie preview. We're very excited. We have a surprise new special guest who will be joining us for that episode. We'll be talking about all of the upcoming fall releases, everything to get us through 2024.
Thank you all for listening. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And we have bonus content on patreon.com/Oscar Wilde. We also have our website with updated nomination predictions again. So check those out at oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.